Did you know that the original Final Fantasy creator, Hironobu Sakaguchi, made a spiritual successor to that legendary series called Fantasian for Apple Arcade, and every level in the game is a handmade, physical miniature model? Enjoy unlimited access to over 200 incredibly fun games with no ads and no in-app purchases. From puzzle and adventure games to sports, racing, and multiplayer action games, everyone can count on finding something to love. Head to sifter.com.au/arcade to start your free trial of Apple Arcade today. That's sifter.com.au/arcade for a 1 month free trial of Apple Arcade, and you'll be supporting independent video games journalism. This offer is for new subscribers only. $9.99 a month after free trial. Plan automatically renews after trial until cancelled. Hello and welcome to episode 57 of Pixel Sift. This week we're back in the House of Quig, and that of course means that me, Gianni, am joined by Scott, and tagging along is Mitch. Today we've also got John Kane joining us live over the interwebs. John, thanks for joining us.
Hey guys, how's it going?
It's going really well. We're going to talk a lot about your two very successful games that you've launched this year a little bit later in the show. But first up, though, what else are we checking out today?
Yeah, we'll be having a look at how internet fandom can help lock a game in the spotlight.
Yes, and games don't seem to punish us anymore. I can't remember the last time a game really pushed us and I saw a game over screen. Our last topic for today will be looking at exactly that.
That's what's coming up today on this week's episode of Pixel Sift, so stay tuned and stay frosty.
You're listening to Pixel Sift.
Yeah, so the way most games measure success is the amount of active players they have at one time, or pretty much how much money they make. But this number becomes more impressive as the further the game is down the line after it launches. But what happens when the internet fandom takes over? Could another measurement for success be the level of passion and devotion games inspire in their communities?
Now, Mitch, why are we talking about this particular topic? Why are we talking about fandoms?
Because Undertale is a massive thing on Tumblr, and we are all collectively not sure why.
I think there's a couple of very important reasons as to why this is a, you know, very important game for the people in the Tumblr community. You know, the Tumblr community is obviously all about, this may be a sweeping generalization, if you're on Tumblr. But to me, it feels like it is about fandom, and it is about exploration and enjoyment of things that are out in the real world and sort of people exploring and going from there.
Yeah, it's a huge, I guess, Web 2.0 version of you know, a pop culture kind of pool, I guess.
It feels like, to me, it feels like a grow up of Live Journal.
A grow up.
Yeah, that's good words.
Anyway, Undertale has topped the Tumblr video game charts as the most active video game property in 2016. It came second last year, but it's gotten even more popular over the last 12 months. It was only out for a couple of months last year as well, so for it to reach up that high was pretty impressive on its own. It topped Overwatch as the second, I think, was this year.
Which, of course, is hugely popular on the internet.
Yeah.
Mitch, you and Sarah have been doing a lot of hard research into this particular thing. Well, basically, Sarah's been telling you everything.
By research, I mean Sarah was pretty much lecturing me on the train on the way over here.
So what have you learned?
So one of the conclusions I came up with was pretty much that it seems like a lot of the games that seem to be very successful on the net and that people really latch onto are the games with no actual, like, overt story, even though Undertale does actually have a very overt story, but like it, games that encourage the player to make their own connections between the ideas in the game and that kind of thing.
So you think it's an element of having, you know, an open-ended narrative, and that player-driven narrative is the
absolutely
one that's, like, making it there.
There are a number of different, like, outcomes in Undertale that require the player to do specific things, and they only unlock after subsequent playthroughs of the game. And this kind of dynamics really is something that's very easy to latch onto and to build your own kind of narrative in yourself, in this, in your head, why it's like this.
John, now you've released a couple of games and you've been looking into this this topic as well. Why do you think it is about Undertale that's kind of, you know, people have captured it in their hearts?
Yeah. Well, I had a look at the whole sort of the top Tumblr chart of games, and there's like, there's a few sort of like really obvious common factors in almost the entire list. One of them is the ambiguous storytelling, which is like not necessarily ambiguous storytelling, but ambiguous kind of lore behind it. Like all of the Overwatch characters are, you know, you get that character information from voice lines, from the comics. There is a lot of like piecing it together and coming to your own assumptions. Same thing with Mystic Messenger, Pokemon. There's lots of hints at character traits in those games. Fire Emblem as well. There's a lot of also fairly ambiguously, like maybe queer-coded characters in those games. Like there is a lot. Just sort of looking at Undertale, Overwatch, Mystic Messenger. There is a lot of like pseudo queer content in there, and I think those two things tend to inspire people to kind of come up with their own ideals of what is actually going on in the story.
So would you say it's more, descriptive of a situation rather than really prescriptive of what it actually is, and that people are kind of able to take it and, you know, explore those characters and those worlds in ways that make sense to them?
I think it deliberately hints just enough that the people who are looking for that sort of stuff will latch onto it. And then, you know, those communities are all about fan art and all about like making your own thing and sharing it. And that drives huge amounts of online conversation. Like Overwatch fan art is just a ridiculous flood of content.
Yeah, you're right. It's not a, you know, it's no mistake that those top kind of games on the Tumblr activity list are also very kind of meme friendly and fan art friendly. They're very friendly with that side of the internet.
I like the idea of, like, I like how you mentioned headcanon, like that kind of thing, like the stories you make up about the characters in your head, because like we were talking to James Cook last week and he has a number of characters that move between his different titles. And while I was playing his game, I thought, how did they get here? You know, like what wrong turn did they take to end up in this game as opposed to where they came from? And he was like, oh no, we just needed some assets.
Yeah, we just need to reuse our assets.
I had made up in my head some weird story about how they got here.
Yeah, I think this is an interesting, and I think it's a testament to the quality of the game as well. And Undertale, for people who probably haven't played it, it is an indie game, but it actually does sort of flip a lot of the paradigms that we see in game design. For example, it's sort of a, you know, SNES-ish era looking RPG style game, and you normally would go through those games basically killing everything that moves, because that's sort of the instructions that you've been given in every other game prior to that point. But in this, there are sort of very concrete real-world consequences for your actions, and every action that you make, in fact, has a judgment associated with it. So, you know, I think that sort of taking this sort of standard model of something and kind of twisting that to a slightly different thing is why it's made it so interesting for people.
Yes. Yeah, it is definitely a lot deeper than it appears when you first kind of look at it. It is also by the guy who, I think he worked on Homestuck and the kind of MS Paint Adventure
series.
Like there was already a huge following. Yeah,
I think. John, is this something that you've sort of experienced with the games that you've been creating? Is that something that you'd like to see if it hasn't happened yet?
Well, I mean, I certainly would like to see fan art of, you know, characters from Killing Time. But I definitely did leave a lot of kind of ambiguous story notes in there to see how and whether or not people would pick up on those. And certainly, like, other people who have talked about the game publicly have kind of theorized what they think happens at the end and, you know, where do certain characters come up. And while I certainly have like a canonical version in my head, it is really interesting to see how they interpret what is actually in the text.
Is it difficult to leave things out to when you're creating a game and creating a world to say, okay, no, that's enough to put in for now. Let's leave this a little bit more open-ended.
Um, Yes. there does come a point, especially, I mean, there came a point with Killing Time where the scope was just like, I had to actually say, like, this is where it, you know, playing it through from start to end feels good. And, you know, not all of the news articles in the game are viewable, because the news article system kind of like degrades and becomes more image based, and I didn't have the art budget to make all those art assets. So anything that kind of looked like it was just, oh, this news thing is just going to be, look at this picture of a cute dog, I just like made that link unavailable. And the fact that the news articles are not 100% there for most of the game, and they just become more and more unavailable, people lead their own narrative into that and like why those things aren't available. There's story reasons, but also like technical and budget reasons. It's like, well, you know, I couldn't have a huge number of hashtags in the game because that then like exponentially blows out the content that I have to write.
Well,
but there's a couple.
We're going to chat a little bit more about it. We might just jump into our next topic now, where we're going to talk about all of this thing. So let's jump into it.
You're listening to Pixel Sift. Or you might be watching Pixel Sift on Twitch. Pixel Sift.
John, you were talking just there about your game, Killing Time at Lightspeed, which picked up a couple of Australian Game Developer Awards this year. And I guess obviously there was a big factor of that was sort of the representation award that you picked up, and you were very, we talked about this before in when you joined us just after the release of that game, that it was kind of important to include that sort of thing for you. Was it, when you're talking about sort of leaving things out for sort of character reasons, how do you write characters that are kind of open and accessible, but also sort of universal enough so that everyone can kind of relate to them?
Really, whenever I was stuck kind of trying to write those characters, I tended to just kind of pull from people I knew on Twitter. There are definitely things in that game that are kind of mirroring experiences I have with other people on Twitter. Like there's a thread of puns where like it just keeps going, and you can continue that pun thread like over the course of like maybe 2 years in the game. And I've had that happen, like not 2 years, but definitely more than a few days. And so the characters in Killing Time are relatable because they're based on real people and real experiences. And, you know, I could have done the writing for non-white characters. Like, I maybe could have affected the language more to make them more caricatures, but also the people I know on Twitter don't necessarily write tweets like that. So
it becomes a bit reductive.
Yeah, it becomes a tough call as to like how much is characterization and how much is just like oversimplifying.
So, John, how does that, like, did you learn any, like, did you bring any of the gameplay design elements from that to your more action-based game, Melodrops?
Well, Melodrops was in production for, I think, 2 years before I even started on Killing Time. It just needed a lot more polish at the end. There were definitely things I learned from both games that kind of affected each other, because I would do maybe like a month on one and then a month on the other and go back and forth to just sort of keep fresh. The level designs in Melodrops are kind of, they start off from a random seed, and then I kind of just like fill in the puzzle design around this random shape. And using randomness to stop me looking at a blank page every day was something I learned from Killing Time, whereas if I couldn't figure out kind of how a page would flow, I just hit a shuffle. And eventually, like, that was kind of how the game design ended up for Killing Time, was that just those tweets kind of load in a random order every day. And sometimes conversations are kind of like maybe out of alignment or maybe just line up perfectly that two tweets line up together and become a joke.
Which is exactly what happens with social media in real life, isn't it? You know, you have these situations where they do kind of, you know, everything all comes together. Now, in terms of coming together, John, you've had two of your major releases now pick up Australian Game Developer Awards. How did that make you feel when you kind of picked that up just before you had the release of Malodrops a few days later at the sort of opening weekend of PAX?
Yeah, at the actual moment of, you know, I think the first one, I was just so shocked I couldn't even get through, like, the speech and the names that I'd written to thank, and just kind of like got down off the stage as fast as I could to try and sort of catch my breath. Then the second time I had to get up again and I had no idea what to say. So I just read out like all of the authors that contributed and thanked each of them personally. Winning two awards for one game that was, you know, from a point of view, it was the side project to my side project. It was really quite staggering to me, and you know, I worked really hard on that game, but it was still a shock to see like how well it was received. Because when you're making something, you just see all the flaws. You don't see like how much it affects other people.
Do you feel that puts a lot of pressure on you now for any future projects that you've got there? You've got two big games that have come out this year that have now picked up, I guess it's three awards in total, is it, for the for your games there?
Yep.
And
yeah, I was joking that I have to win three for the next one.
Yeah, to one up it.
Yeah, I think there's certainly pressure, but there's also a bit of freedom as well, because the games are so different. No one's expecting Malodrops 2, no one's expecting Killing Time 2. The game I release next could be something just totally different, and I think people would still be happy with that. I've kind of skipped the whole Sophomore album problem by just releasing two games at the one time.
One of the things that you did this time round is you did have kind of a very, I guess, public launch of Malodrops at PAX this year. How did you find that sort of experience of putting it out there and then having to, you know, face the crowds and the fans of Australian indie games?
It did incredibly well in Australian indie games. We were just selling keys left and right at PAX. I don't have exact numbers on how many we sold, but we also did the Penny Arcade pins, which is a PAX collector's pin. The reaction to both of those was incredible. We ended up showing Killing Time and Malodrops both on the show floor and in the Diversity Lounge. So for what is basically a one-man team, we had four game locations, which is kind of huge.
And for a good portion of that, you were kind of bouncing between all of those different locations as well.
Yeah, and doing press interviews. I had a huge number of people helping me pull that off. But it worked really well.
Is it the way you would release games from now on? Are you going to wait until PAX, or is it better to send it out into the world in a slightly different way?
I think perhaps I would try maybe a kind of early access system like itch.io has just launched. Refinery, I think, is their system. There's a game called Overland that's using that. That seems really cool to just... Because I tend to do the art in the last half of the game. It's all game design up till that point. So, you know, I could have something playable even if the graphics aren't great. Launching in PAX worked really well for the Australian press. the timing of that PAX launch kind of coincided with the US presidential election, and that was not something I'd considered, but it
what impact did that sort of thing have? What, like, how does that play into the...
Well, if you were sort of looking at it, looking at Twitter or looking at anywhere on the internet for the time, pretty much all press that wasn't looking at the election kind of stopped for a week, which meant there was very little coverage of anything during that week. And that could have been better for us with this game. But I think, you know, there's still mobile releases, there's still more updates coming to try and swing that around. But really, if I was going to launch something again, I would make sure I had some kind of US coverage.
So what is the plans for John Kane and Gritfish into the future? You mentioned a mobile release there. What else are you kind of working on in amongst working full-time?
The next sort of major chunk of development for me is mobile tablet ports of Killing Time and Mallow Drops, getting those out, and then releasing the level editor for Mallow Drops and hopefully Steam Workshop and support for that, that I had to pull at the last minute because it just wasn't going to be done at time. So, putting out a Steam update for the PC version of Mallow Drops that basically will give you a kind of Mario Maker experience.
So the game that has just come out, well, about a month and a bit ago. Oh, no, we're in December now. Yeah, it was
about a month ago.
Is Mallow Drops by John Kane. John, if people want to play your game, where's the best place for them to find more info, or what can they do if they want to just have a look?
Sure. If you go to mallowdrops.com or Google Mallow Drops, you'll find it. Mallowdrops.com has links to the Steam page and the Humble Store page. Same thing with Killing Time. It's killingtime@lightspeed.com. And that, again, has purchase links to the Steam page, the Humble page, and the itch.io store. Speaking of itch.io, Killing Time was just in the A Good Bundle yeah. that they did, which
raised over $100,000 for ACLU and I think Planned Parenthood in the US.
Was Planned Parenthood, yeah. 160,000 US, which was just freaking incredible. So unfortunately, people have missed out on that by a few days, but
definitely for a good
cause.
There
was definitely, a lot of good free games in there as well that are probably still free.
It's really interesting games, both the games that you've made, Killing Time and Lightspeed, which is kind of like a, you know, space dilated social media simulator and narrative game, and then Mallow Drops, which is a sort of semi-Sokoban style, twisty, puzzly sort of game with cute little birds in it. They're both very good fun. We will, John, stick around because we're going to jump into our next topic now, and we'll talk a little bit about our next topic.
Hey, this is Fabian Malabello, the director of the Otherworld Agency, and you're listening to Pixel Sift.
So, many modern games are a testament to streamlined mechanics and fluid game design, but has that made them too easy? Is the abundance of save points and unlimited lives really enriching the gaming world, or simply taking the challenge right out of the experience? Our last topic for today is asking, why don't games let us fail anymore?
I had a really good thought about this.
Yes,
a bit of a shower
Lay
thought
it on
this
me.
Morning.
So intimate.
There's an interesting sort of generational thing to do with the game design. The original sort of console gaming that most people would have played, and even before that, the games that people would have been playing were arcade games, and they were 20-cent power card. You know, they were coin-based games where you paid for lives, and there was
just like, let everyone know I know what a power card is.
It's yep. basically a prepaid.
No,
card.
I know what it is.
Yeah. You do? Yeah. You do?
I thought that yeah. was for the younger
the younger generation of yeah. people in not in Western Australia.
I've never used one. It's but I know what it is.
But it's a prepaid card, or basically like that, where you would play it in an arcade and play these games with a limited number of lives because you need to get off the machine and let other people have a go. Uh-huh. And I think as games have moved away from that arcade sort of setting, we're starting to see the end of this final lives game over sort of situation. And which for some people is not good because that's not the era of games that they were used to. They were used to the older style games where you did have limited lives.
Well, that's an easy reason for people to like hail back to the arcade time being the best time for gaming, because the challenges would have been quite high for everything.
And you probably couldn't play as much as you would really like because you'd run out of 20-cent pieces and have to stop.
No, I remember playing Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles on the arcade back in the day, and that was really
yes.
hard. Like, and I just and constantly getting just owned in it and really upset because didn't have enough coins to keep playing.
I played a lot of Metal Slug back in the day as well on the arcade, and Virtua Cop.
Yeah, okay, Virtua Cop.
And, you know, having limited amount of plays and you just like, oh, one more go. I think if you think about it, like one of the games that's kind of made this transition into the modern era of basically unchanged in an arcade-style game is Mario. Well, the Mario series of games are still very live and power-up-based sort of games, and similar to what they used to be.
Yeah, the Mario Bros., the Super Mario Bros. Lost levels. Even though, this is an old game, they were really, really difficult. I remember the kind of learning curve being quite high, even for a Mario game. But, you know, there's games that still challenge people these days. The Demon Souls and the whole Dark Souls kind of series as well. Obviously, kind of the easy go-to challenging game at the moment. But even that, like, you can still go, you've still got save points, you can still kind of just have another go at it sort of thing. There's none of those you've actually stuffed up, start a new character or start from the start again. That really, really, really happens anymore.
Unless you're talking about Undertale, for example, where you can stuff up the game.
You've just made a choice. You can still finish it. You know, there's some of these other games where you got to a certain point, you could lose something or trade something away that you would actually, in effect, just kind of ruin yourself from finishing the game.
John, what sort of games do you lean towards? Like,
so with Undertale will actually account for you trying to delete your save file and then like punish you for that. So if you screw up and then try and delete your save file and start again, it will see you doing that. That is accounted for in the game,
I love that, freaking
genius.
I have to get on Game Facts and see if there's a way to get around that particular thing.
They'll know.
The other reason games like made you fail and like had that forced end state is because they couldn't save. When you turned the console off, like your save in, like all of the data in Mario got wiped.
Well, they used to, the NES cartridges used to have a small battery that would actually keep it going sort of thing, even the original.
What about your Atari generation? That sort of stuff didn't have any of that.
No, absolutely not.
That early generation of games and game design that he's talking about was like, well, you can't leave things unfinished and come back to them.
Yeah. You need to make it a complete kind of sit down, start to finish, if it is really hard.
I do feel like one of the modern influences of games, I guess the challenge now comes from the availability of multiplayer for everyone. So if you really want that next challenge and the hard gameplay, you go up against extra people, or you go up against real people.
Mm.
So that's...
I do actually think that he's almost kind of like the idea that AAA games don't have any fail states. One of the things he lists as like a thing that doesn't have fail states is Call of Duty Infinite Warfare. I haven't played that one, but I played Ghosts, and Ghosts had a ton of fail states. Ghosts like gave me a mission failed and just like cut to black and restarted the mission because I looked at a house for too long. Like I was just like checking out the scenery and then it just gave me a game over screen.
Yeah,
so
enjoying the art for too much.
Yeah,
like when you play a game, like you want to win. Like you know, if you're gonna lose, it's gonna make you unhappy. And like there is that kind of give and take. You need to make it neither too hard nor too easy. But like you know, what is it? There's a good article. Well, there's a good paper actually by Wolf and Perrin called "The Video Games Theory Reader," and that says the simplest theory of failure states that failing serves as a contrast to winning, and like the failure therefore like needs makes winning all more enjoyable. I think the lack of that kind of dynamic in newer games is why people are kind of bitching about the quality of our bigger AAA titles at the moment.
There are really interesting games which, you know, incorporate failure as a part of the game. You think about games like Binding of Isaac, for example, where failing is a very important factor of that game. But all the roguelike sort of style games as well are kind of all about that. But it's kind of like, I feel like the failure isn't so impossible now that it is a disincentive to do certain things.
There's not as much like white knuckle gaming, I guess. Like, you're not really sweating that hard.
Well, I know from my perspective as well, like if a game is super frustrating and I have got limited time to play it, and I get destroyed a couple of times, my enthusiasm for coming back to the game will be pretty low. So, you know, I think this is kind of an evolution of that era.
Exactly. You need that give and take between it being neither too hard nor too easy. Like, you know, failure adds content to the game by making you kind of learn the nuances and the harder tricks of how to get through it. And there's plenty of new games that are ticking that box. I feel like Super Meat Boy was really good in a challenging kind of way and not too forgiving.
The
specific design thing that he mentions, which is you can be playing an RPG and make a mistake early on, and it like that run at that game is ruined forever, and you will never come back from it. That's like the core of Dota, of League of Legends, of all of those MOBA-style games. I think, like, he's complaining about there being no fail states in AAA games, but it's just not the AAA blockbuster, like, first-person releases that... There are games that are all about those fail states. He's just not looking at them.
Everywhere. For the listeners as well, we're referring to an article on Reddit from True Gaming that was speaking very broadly about this topic. John was referencing there.
I think you've nailed it there, John, is that the multiplayer and competitive multiplayer in particular is 100% about that, and especially team-based one. You know, you need that cohesion and you need to get it right in order to win.
Absolutely.
And losing is... 50% of the experience.
Also, raid culture in video games, like your raids in WoW and Destiny. It's like you need to do this thing, otherwise it just doesn't get done, and it might not get done.
I'm really glad John said that, because it's a thought I had earlier today. I was thinking the same thing with raids or basically anything you're playing online competitively. That's why you play, because that risk of failure is so much higher than just playing AI.
Well, look, it's been always very interesting to have you to join us, John. Congratulations on your awards, picking up two for Killing Time at Lightspeed to add to the one that you got for Mallow Drops last year. If people want to find out more about your games, where's the best places for them to go to find out more?
Sure. Both games are pretty easy to Google, but Mallow Drops is at mallowdrops.com. And Killing Time at Lightspeed is at killingtimeatlightspeed.com. And you can find me and my games at gritfish.net.
Find you on Twitter as well, because you're very lovely to chat to on there and join the gaming Twitter sphere. We have a website. It is www.pixelsift.com.au. On there, you'll find links to John's games. You'll find links to that Reddit article talking about the demise of the fail state in gaming, and plenty of other cool things that we found throughout the week. But Scott, we're also going to be on social media, aren't we?
Yes, we are, and will be, and continue to be. Facebook.com/pixelsift, Twitter.com/pixelsift, Twitch.tv/pixelsift, and YouTube.com/pixelsiftau.
And Mitch, we have got 56 episodes before this one. Where can they be found?
Yeah, they can be found on the site, or you can stream episodes using either iTunes, Pocket Casts, or using the RSS link on our page. And shout out to the girls and boys at Game Design AIE and Melbourne. I know you're listening, so cheers for that.
Shout out.
Thank you for listening in. We'll be back again this time next week for another episode of Pixel Sift. John, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
we'll see you guys next time.
If you're in the market for a super addictive puzzle game, you have to check out Mini Motorways on Apple Arcade. It's a city planning strategy puzzler with an incredibly satisfying gameplay loop. Enjoy unlimited access to over 200 incredibly fun games with no ads and no in-app purchases. From puzzle and adventure games to sports, racing, and multiplayer action games, everyone can count on finding something to love. Head to sifter.com.au/arcade to start your free trial of Apple Arcade today. That's sifter.com.au/arcade for a free 1 month trial of Apple Arcade, and you'll be supporting independent video games journalism. New subscribers only, $9.99 a month after free trial. Plan automatically renews after trial until cancelled.